Hello, my name is Tucker Johnson, and I am your host today as we experience NIMSY Live, where we talk about the latest and greatest in translation, localization, internationalization, culturalization, and all that fun stuff global companies need to delight their international customers. On this program, we invite guests who like to have fun and have some value to add for our audience of globalization professionals. I'm always eager to provide a platform to those with a good story or a good data set. So let us know if there are any topics you'd like covered or guests that we should reach out to for future episodes. If you haven't already done so, make sure that you are subscribed to NIMSY Insights on your platform of choice. We're coming to you live today on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, or X. Maybe, and YouTube, of course. So whichever platform you prefer, make sure you subscribe to NIMSY Insights and you'll be the first to hear about latest industry research that we publish and when we schedule new events like this under the NIMSY Live banner. I'm going to get right into it today without a whole lot of pomp and circumstances and plugging different things, and introduce our topic. For those of you joining us live today, if you've signed up for it, you already know that we're talking about large language models and AI, neural machine translation, all that stuff. So let's get into it. Neural machine translation has been leading AI translation solution for several years. However, with the promise and progress of large language models, led notably by ChatGPT, what's the right technology for translation and localization processes? Are LLMs too immature, or is translation a potential area to develop your corporate large language model strategy? Unbabel CTO and co-founder Joe Garza, I should have asked you how to pronounce your name. I hope I'm doing that all right. You're going to be leading our conversation today, talking about Unbabel's investment into translation large language models and the state of technology and the potential applications in translation. Quick introduction to my guest here today. We're joined by Joe Garza, co-founder and chief technology officer of Unbabel. Joe holds a PhD in natural language processing and has an impressive background in machine learning and computational linguistics. After completing postdoctoral research at the University of Pennsylvania, where he developed innovative statistical learning methods, Joe chose to pursue entrepreneurship. He co-founded Unbabel in 2013, bringing his expertise in language technology to revolutionize AI-powered translation. As a computational genius with both academic and entrepreneurial experience, Joe is uniquely positioned to discuss the evolving landscape of AI translation technology. Welcome to the show. First and foremost, am I slaughtering your name? And then did I miss anything in the introduction?
No, you didn't miss anything. And I think the name is okay.
Perfect. Well, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for taking time today. It's a hot topic. Everyone wants to talk about AI, large language models, and I feel that I always feel very fortunate when I get to talk to someone like yourself, because I think there's a lot of guys out there like me with podcasts who are talking about AI and large language models, but we don't really know what we're talking about. And you have the chops, you have the background and the degrees to prove it, to talk about this. So I'd like to just open up by talking about what has been your impression on this hype over AI large language models that we've seen. It really started in 2023 with the proliferation or the expansion of ChatGPT, of course, is almost become synonymous with it. But over the last 12, 18 months, what has been your impression on what's going on, not just in our industry, but in general?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, I think ChatGPT had a bit of a magic experience.
Yeah.
And basically it brought AI to the consumer and people were not using AI directly. And the fact that you're just like talking with the computer, and so far the experience had been very bad. It's like basically like templates that you're talking and ChatGPT could answer all your questions. And I think that from a research perspective, it was really amazing, like these instruction models that you can then chat, ask questions in chat. They just brought something different from what we had before. So I think that was kind of like everybody was overwhelmed with ChatGPT and basically all the models that came afterwards. I think there's like there's three things that are very interesting happening right now. So one is generative AI. Everybody's talking about it and having a huge impact in a lot of places. And I'll comment a little bit on that. I think that on our industry, LLMs are useful for a lot of tasks besides machine translation. And I'm happy to dive into that because I think that localization is much more than machine translation. But then they also like state of the art for machine translation for several reasons. And so this puts us in a position where we transition from one technology to the other one. Same happened when everybody was doing phrase-based MT and neural MT came along. And whenever there's this transition period, there's an adaptation period. Some people take sides about, is this really the new big thing? It's not the new big thing. It will become, is it already? And I think it's kind of the phase that we are right now in terms of LLMs in the localization industry. And overall, I think everyone is still discovering the power that these models have. So every time there's a new model coming, there's like a couple of new functionality, new features, a new way to prompt. So it's really like a very exciting time to be on AI or working with AI.
Yeah, I feel that so companies like you, people like you, you have, this is part of your background. You've been studying this sort of stuff for a very long time, and everyone else is basically trying to catch up. So when this started, when AI started coming to the forefront over the last year or so, what were some of the first things that you thought, this is what we need to do, specifically for the language services industry? Because you mentioned the applications with machine translation. Machine translation has been around for a while, right? Yes. Well, first of all, let me ask you this. Is machine translation AI?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Settled. Because that's what I've been telling people. We've been using AI in this industry for a very long time. And I think that's a very compelling conversation to have, because right now, especially on the enterprise side, lots of buyers of localization services, their bosses are coming to them and saying, what are you doing with AI? And I think a very interesting way to start that conversation is, well, we've been using AI for quite some time. It's called machine translation. Yes. But how are large language models and machine translation, how are they related? How do they complement each other? And what are the additional applications for AI?
Okay, so first of all, machine translation was probably the first application of AI, the thing that started the field or that started a lot of the practical applications.
It's fair to say that the language services industry has been doing AI since way before it was cool, right?
Yes, and also it's also fair to say that the model that is behind LLMs, the transformer model, was made for translation. It was a model that was created to do machine translation. So the thing is, like, I think that LLMs were less disruptive on the translation industry than they were in other industries, because we're already using like transformer models and large language models, maybe not so large, for a long time. And for other industries, this has basically become the new thing. I mean, all this discussion about humans being replaced or not being replaced, I mean, we've been dealing with that for at least since Babel was born 10 years ago with machine plus editing, right? The combination between AI and humans to a certain extent. So neural MT, again, is a transformer model. And basically large language model is also a transformer model. It's trained differently. So it's trained on like, not just bilingual text, just like general data, can have different languages. And it's trained to answer questions. And one of the questions can be, can I translate this from A to B? It's much bigger.
Yeah.
And so the question is, does this size compensate the fact that it's not trained specifically for translation? And I think the answer is yes. And the results show that just asking the simple question, can I translate from A to B? The latest LLMs already perform better than the best NMDs. Now,
say that again. The large language models are performing better than the traditional machine translation models.
Yeah.
Interesting.
With this basic prompt. But this is just the beginning. Because and the difference is not that big. Because again, if you're doing a neural machine translation with a large model, you're not that far away from an LLM. It's just the training is different. Like if you look at the model from the no language left behind, it's a huge LLM. It's just ranges for translation. So it's not that like they're not that far apart. It's not that they're different things. It's actually very similar.
Model. The foundational technology is the same. Okay.
The difference is like you can have a neural MT that is much smaller. Like 100 million parameters as opposed to like billion parameters. Now, the thing is like, because large language models allow this declarative way to pass information, where you can say, translate this from English to Spanish, but translate this for customer X, style guides are these, and terminology is that. And by the way, I already translated these previous sentences. You can build this literally, like I just said, like writing, and the performance of the translation becomes much bigger. And this for me is what's really different, because trying to use this on NeuralMT was super hard. I mean, people were playing to pass terminology to NeuralMT for ages with factors. We were doing NeuralMT before LLMs. Like, we have like 8 years of experience developing our own NeuralMT systems. It was super hard. Passing context, it was hard and very kind of like dubious if it was working properly or not. And if you wanted to codify the style guides, there was no way. If you wanted to pass like similar translation memories, there was some ways, but all of that was much more complex. Now that became very simple. And so I think it's like, it's not that you're just better as they are right now. There's some caveats. They're like, you have this extra loop that you can do very easily that you couldn't do before. So for me, there's no question that LLMs are the present and the future of machine translation. Again, we think we're in the transition period. So you can always find examples that NeuralMT is still better because it's faster, because for this combination, I get this, my own model that is super fine-tuned, that is better. But again, if you go back to 2000, like when NeuralMT came out, this was exactly the same discussion that we're having. If you look at the papers from there, there was these discussions about, is NeuralMT going to be best phrase? And then a lot of people saying, no, some examples, but no. And reality was, they were. And I think we're going over the same transition period.
All right. Well, you've already answered like half of the questions that I wrote for this interview. So, and we've got a lot of time left. But in chat, I see your questions over there in chat. We're going to get to those in just a sec. If anyone has any questions, now's the time. Throw them in chat so I can bring them back up here. But I wanted to talk a little bit about Unbabel, the work that you're doing at Unbabel. What's different today that you're investing in? What areas are you investing in today that you weren't investing in 2 years ago?
Yeah, so maybe it's worth saying where we were 2 years ago. So again, like I said, and I think this is an interesting topic to talk about, there's much more on localization than machine translation. And so for the last like 8 years, Unbabel has been working a lot on our own machine translation systems. The other thing that we're very well known is for like our own QE system. So we've been like leading QE for the last 8 years, winning the competitions, because we believe that QE is the thing that is empowering the adoption of AI, because it tells you, can I trust this or not? And so we keep investing very hard in QE. By the way, QE is one of the examples that the best model is not an LLM yet. We believe it will be, but it's not. The Comet QI is still better than the best LLM we can get. It's a transition period. We're investing a lot of entity recognition. We're investing a lot on algorithms to do localization of entities. So there was a bunch of like, all this diverse set of pieces of AI that we're training. And we're training all of them per language pair, per customer, per brand. So we build this humongous infrastructure that will basically monitor data coming from our customers. Once it reaches a threshold, you basically set a retraining loop. It will retrain all the models. It will replace the models on production, go again. So this was a lot of effort on MLOps before they were like proper MLOps infrastructures. But this is what we need to do to keep the quality always up to date to our customers. Now, what we realize is like you can get one model, one LLM that performs all these tasks and that performs them better than every of the individual models. So now instead of having hundreds of empty models, hundreds of linear models, you have one model and all you're changing is the prompt. And so once we realized that this was happening, we basically went all in with our LLM. And so we're basically focusing, we're still developing a lot of our discriminative QI because it's really strong. And actually our QI is what makes Tower so good, because it allows us to filter the data in a way that we only use high quality data. And these models are very sensitive to high quality data. Mm-hmm. But then we're basically going all in on Tower LLM. And what that means is we have two models, we have a 7B and a 30B. We're training a 70B, we're training a 2B. And at the same time, we're adding more languages, we're adding more tasks, we're understanding better what's the instructions that we need to do. Because one thing we observe is, if you want to query the model to say, translate this, given this context, and these translation memories, and these style guides, and all these things, then if you create instructions that represent that during the instruction tuning, then you actually get better performance than if you just prompt it without doing it. So you're kind of telling the model a little bit of like, what type of questions we're going to ask. And that's very useful. And then looking at like other use cases for LLMs besides these basic ones. And one that for me was like overwhelming and amazing was like the transcreation. So because we used to work a lot on customer service 4 or 5 years ago, we soon identified that if you have agents writing in English to a customer who's going to receive the message in Japanese, there's all this context of like the cultural of Japan that needs to be incorporated. And so we had to write these detailed style guides for the agents to write, to read, so that they knew how to write the email. Now, what we realized is like we can actually use those, and actually with some extra work, give that to an LLM and say, rewrite the text. And then suddenly you can automate this process by doing transcreation automatically. And these results are amazing. They are really, really interesting. And so I think basically LLMs open a lot of doors. It's up for us in the industry to have our creativity to develop them. And the other thing that's very interesting is like, you don't need to have like a research scientist to build these things. You need them, one, to build power. But then we actually have a lot of our in-house linguists actually playing with the prompts because they do have a lot of knowledge about language. And now they can code the AI in natural language. So again, this massively open like the things we can do with LLMs. And I mean, again, I'm very excited because it's a very exciting time. So I think I covered a lot of things.
Well, and things are changing, which is things are always changing. That's not new, right? What's new to me, by my estimation, is the rate of change at which things are changing. Things are just taking off like crazy here. So super exciting times. Let's go to chat. Because I had a question here, and I think we already kind of talked about it. How about Blue comparative with large language models? Like, because you're talking about quality.
Yes.
How is that quality measured? Are traditional machine translation quality metrics, are they still relevant? Do they need to be adapted? What do you say about that?
Yeah, I'll say something. I hope people don't get offended, but don't use Blood to compare NT. That's done like 4 or 5 years ago. You have to use Comet. It's better on Comet. It's better on Comet. It's better on MQ annotations than by linguists. I'm not sure if the team measures Blue. I don't look at it. I don't think it's a worthwhile metric.
Okay. Just curious. Why not?
Because it was shown to not correlate well with human quality. After a given threshold of quality of the translation, like the results are not trustworthy.
All right.
And I'm defending Comet because it is the best according to the WMT competition.
Yeah.
And it's open source and is becoming the standard. But there are also other good metrics as Blurred from Google. There's other semantic metrics that are also good. Just Blue, like this lexical form, that metric is not good anymore. So it's a legacy thing that most papers have been seeing are abandoning it, still holding it, but I don't think it's something that we should use.
Right. I feel like we could have a whole podcast on that topic, but I'd need to bring someone besides myself who can ask better questions. So
and also bring someone that can give better answers, to be honest.
We should have a debate, organize a debate. I can moderate a debate, but I can't ask intelligent questions about Blue scores. So, all right. Thanks for that. I see some more questions here. Hello, everybody in chat. Raphael asks, Joe, do you think that at this moment, the massive amount of English data has an influence on large language model performance? It's known English usually comprises 95% of data and other languages 5%. What do you think?
Yes, I do. And that's exactly... So basically, let me tell you a little bit what Tower is, because I think that's important. Let's tell a little bit the story, because that's...
Yeah, like talk about the product developed.
A year of work. So Tower is, we start from a foundational model. So we played with Llama 2, Mistral, Llama 3, Jamba. And then we do continuous pre-training. And this phase is super important. And this is because these models were not trained to be multilingual. So they're kind of like multilingual has a secondary effect. They're not intentionally built to be multilingual. And what we do is we create this huge multilingual data set and we do continuous pre-training. So what you get after this phase is a model that is much better at addressing different languages. And this is exactly to mitigate what you're asking. And then the second phase is we have our own set of instructions that are highly curated that we use to do the instruction tuning part together with generic. And this is what gives us the boost. But definitely, these models are not multilingual. So at the same time that we're doing this starting from a foundational model and doing these loops on top, we're also part of an European consortium training a Aero LLM. So it's a LLM for all European languages plus other languages. And this is being trained from scratch with data, which is a diverse set of data from all the languages. And like the research question here is like, can you actually get better performance than you can with this addition of continuous pre-training? Because it's a very important conversation. But yes, definitely, like models suffer from language. And in fact, one thing we note, and again, this is a side effect, so I don't want to claim merit, is we train the model to be very good at MT, QE, NER, source correction, and a couple of tasks that we care about. So we're not focusing on the other tasks or creating special instructions. But when we're training on Mistral, we realize that if we use Tower versus Mistral on a bunch of the common benchmarks that were multilingual, but this was question answering, Tower is actually slightly better. And my kind of like hunch without having some deep analysis is because the model learned more about languages, so could answer the languages better. Now, the ability to answer comes from Mistral, not from what we had in Babel. What they got from Babel is this ability to learn how to deal with languages. So I do think that these models, when they're intentional trained to be multilingual, versus like there was some multilingual data on the data sets, hence he knew some language, they will become better. That's my current belief.
Very good. And that kind of brings us, segues us nicely into our next question here, which is, because you're talking about training the model, Gwen van de Graaff asks, can you explain a little bit about the process of how you created a proprietary LLM and why you decided to create one rather than using an existing one? I think you kind of already touched on the reasoning behind that, but if you could expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very pertinent question. So we played a lot with ChatGPT and GPT-4 and other models internally in prompting them. So there are several things. So one is, as a translation company and has a company like is an AI company for the last 10 years, we think we can do better than using those models for these problems at hand. There's a question of security, like do our customers want to send the data to these generic models? But there's also the question that we believe we can get better quality out of our models. And then there's a part of cost. Like these models are such a specific part of our pipeline that we want to be able to control the cost. And you control the cost by having our own models. And we've been playing, I mean, if you think about it, like the last versions of our LLMs were, sorry, of QI, they were large language models. They were not just like the instruction tuned models. We had an empty model that was a large language model. So we've been playing with these models for quite some time. So it was a natural step to go further. But I would say it's like cost reduction, quality increase, and have the control and security. Because otherwise, if all you get to play is with the prompt, you're slightly more limited on what you can do, and you cannot leverage all the data that we have accumulated over time.
Yeah, so cost reduction, quality, security, leveraging your data. Would you recommend, and the answer is probably no, because why would you create new competitors for you out there, right? But objectively, like someone who's just getting started today, I founded an LSP a month ago, and I want to start looking into using this in technology. Would you recommend to me that I build my own model or use existing models, hybrid approach?
I wouldn't just for the beginning for several reasons. So first of all, I think that any company, including Babel, the first thing they have to learn is how to productize LLMs properly. And this is not just calling a ChatGPT API. This is like, you know, most TMSs, they basically work at segment level. So good luck on passing context of the previous document to the sentence. So there's a part of like, how do I productize an LLM? And this is literally irrelevant if it's Tower, ChatGPT, whatever. They're like the infrastructure that needs to change to be able to use it properly. So let's assume that you've done that. Then there's all this product development on top of an LLM. And I just mentioned some examples that we did in Babel, but there are many more. I think that a lot of the localization industry is jumping at this. So I've seen like really cool examples from other companies doing on top of LLMs. So there's like a huge value added to do this. Then once you have done these two things, I think the reason is like, do you have to know how to build an LLM? Because if you don't, it will take time. And it's not building in the sense of like training a model. It's like, how do you run these things in production? These things consume GPUs. You need to know how to do scale down to zero. Otherwise, you'll pay a huge amount of, you know, there's a lot of know-how of just running these pieces, training these pieces that you need to have. So you have to build a team for that. Then, you know, there's a bunch of steps. So yes, if you have all of these and you have data and you have QE to filter the data and you have a linguistic team that is used to evaluate models for the last 10 years, if you have all these pieces like we have, then I guess yes, because you can reduce margin and cost. But is this my first step? No, and it was not my first step at Unbabel, our first step was let's adopt LLMs and see how they work on the pipeline, because I think that's where a lot of the value is coming from. I think then Tower brings another percentage of optimization, but if you're just starting as an LSP, there's so many interesting things that you can do right now. Like look at the particular use case of localization that no one is looking at and solve it. So for instance, like think about when you need to look at a picture to do a translation. Like I remember like some eBay content from a long time ago that killed my brain, because you really have to use the picture to understand what you're translating. You can now solve that with a multimodal MT. So go play with that and discover and solve that niche, because before you had to pass it to the translator.
Yeah.
Now you can do something different. Another example, remember that specific instruction that you have to do, like the low-level instruction that you have to pass to the translator so to be able to do good translation. There was no way you could pass it to the LLM. Now you can. Yeah. So there's so many things that now you can, that my option was not going to be, let's implement an LLM from scratch.
Yeah. Great answer. Thank you. So it sounds, step one, experiment.
Yeah.
Play around with it. Get your hands dirty. Figure it out. You know, break stuff, make mistakes, and just kind of build your literacy around the topic, it sounds like. And I think that's the mode that a lot of us are in right now.
Yep.
I want to go back, because you mentioned, for talking about the reasons why you decided to invest in LLM technology, and one of them is reducing costs, right? Mm-hmm. Now, this is because you have your proprietary system that you've developed specifically to improve your margins on this and be able to offer a lower cost. But in general, if I'm just leveraging other LLMs from whoever, right? I don't have my own proprietary model. One of the big question marks for me, at least, and for a lot of people out there that I'm talking to, is cost. Mm-hmm. The cost structure is really hard to understand. In the translation industry, we have per word pricing, which is not a great model, but it's the model that we have and is predictable. With large language models, you're buying tokens, but what does a token get me? Is it more expensive to translate with out-of-box LLMs than it would be with traditional machine translation, or is it cheaper?
There's a lot of answers to this. So
yeah.
So first of all, if you think about characters and words, token sits in between. So tokens are sets of characters. So you can do an approximation like how many tokens are there per word, and you can convert from one to the other one. Then the costs of like what you put on the prompt are different from what you translate. And if you always use the same prompt, you cannot pay for that. So there's some arithmetic to do this there. The other thing is, in practice, if you buy ChatGPT for translation, is a third of the cost of, for instance, DeepL. And that for me is very weird. So that is a practice. If you right now, LLMs are cheaper than MT.
Really?
If you look at the intent to report, I think they say on average 10x. I don't know exactly the value, but that's the value there. So it's, in general, they're cheaper. Now, I don't understand why. And so my theory, and again, this is like my theory, I don't have nothing to support, is that there's such a war for like what's the LLM that wins, that they are sponsoring a lot of the costs, because these models are much bigger than MT. If you think about it, like what costs money on these things is the size of the model. So running a transformer model for neural MT, which is slightly different than an LLM. An MT is an encoder decoder. LLM is just decoder, but they're very similar. It's not about being neural MT or LLM. It's about the number of parameters. So if you run a neural MT with a lot of parameters, like the no language left behind, I think has 40 billions. I might be wrong. But if you run a 40 billion neural MT in a 40 billion LLM, the cost of infrastructure is going to be pretty much the same. Given that most LLMs have much more parameters than the traditional neural MT, they should be more expensive. The fact that they are not is surprising. But right now, if you're just buying a word per word, LLMs are cheaper. I also don't know how to explain that, but that's the fact that's happening right now.
Very interesting. Yeah, it makes me, I don't want to put my tinfoil hat on, right? But like you're alluding to, I'm wondering if the prices are artificially low at this period, and then they're going to jump up.
But also consider that when you're buying these APIs, you're paying like a 90% margin for all the companies, or 90-something percent margin of software. So you have, like, if you build it your own and develop your own,
yeah,
You know, and one
then,
option
then
is
you can charge a 90% margin if you develop your own, right?
Yeah, all else, we're all here.
All
to
it takes
like
is data. Yeah.
So.
Another question coming up. Thanks, chat. You guys are keeping the conversation going here. Let's go to David Clark here. Says, Joe, why do you think more is not being done to protect large language models from being polluted by public data sets, particularly non-English sets that are not verified? Because recent research suggests the consequences could be severe. Thank you, David Clark.
I mean, I'm not sure what polluted means, if it's like because of some toxic behavior, or if it's because there are tests that you used to evaluate, or if it's because they don't have quality. I can tell that we saw over this year a huge improvement on quality by using QI to filter out sentences, to filter out things that have quality.
You've mentioned QI before. What is QI? Yeah.
QI is quality estimation. So it's an algorithm that basically even two sentences tells what's the quality of the translation.
Okay.
This is something that we've been working for at least 9 years. There's a shared task on WMT. It involves, so it used to be just like, what's the effort to correct?
Okay.
Then it went to a score, then you can have error annotation. So you can do a lot of stuff now, but it's pretty big on the translation industry right now. Everybody's talking about it this year.
Yeah. I just hadn't heard QI before. Or are you saying QE? Is it QE or QI? Well,
QE is quality evaluation.
Right.
And that we have something which is called QI, which is quality intelligence, which is basically a way to group scores of QE into buckets that are more meaningful and to predict MQM-like scores.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I just never heard that before. QI. I need to get out more often. Okay. great. So let me try to rephrase what I think David's question is behind. When it comes to training models using data sets, and you can talk about your model, you can talk about the other public models out there, what sort of due diligence is going into making sure that the data is high quality, meaning let's just go with like accurate, right? We live in the world of, you know, say what you will about this, but we live in the world of quote unquote fake news, right? So there's all sorts of data out there. Not all of it's necessarily verified. Some of it's not verifiable, right? So before feeding a data set into an engine, what do you do to make sure that it's
so let me break this into two parts. I think there's the foundational model part. Like if you're training a Llama 2 or ChatGPT, I mean, I don't know all that they do. I think they do effort to try to clean the data, but it's very hard with the amount of data to check the factuality because they don't have written that says this is factual or not. And actually, I think most of the problems doesn't come from that. Most of the problems come because we don't agree what's factual and what's not factual. And so we get what the internet says. So on our case, if you think that we're working, like we're training the model to be very good at translating stuff, basically the factuality means is what on the target corresponds to what's on the source. We're not saying, is the source correct or not? Which, by the way,
for now, right?
We're doing a project for the medical domain.
Uh-huh.
And one of the challenges is, okay, so we can give you QE for linguistic quality. We're now developing something really cool, which is, do we adhere to the European guidelines? Which is basically like just a complex style guide that you can make an LLM say, okay, you're doing on this. Think about it like another quality annotation. But you can check if the thing is factual or not. Like an algorithm to tell if something is factual is very hard. I would love to work on that, but we're not working on that. Now, in terms of like the factuality, like is this translation a good translation of the other one? This is exactly what QE does and what QE is very good at.
Okay.
And so what we did on the steps that we did that care about the multilinguality and like, are you translating properly? Basically, what we have is this algorithm that we pass through all the data that we train, and we discard all the data that is not good. Or sometimes we just tell our community to say, correct these ones and put them back here.
Okay.
Yeah. This also generates, by the way, there's something really cool, which is, you can basically now have a loop that every time there's an error, you correct the sentence and basically you just tell the model you already have an instruction. And because we're using RAG with the closest sentences, you basically correct it and it's used on the next iteration. So the loops to basically correct errors when you have human loop or not became much faster and much more efficient, which is also very, very cool.
That's, yeah, and to me that's crazy, right? Like, I remember the first conversation I had about this was months and months ago. But just still to me it's crazy, this idea that the machines are evaluating the machines, right?
Yep.
And it gets to, it's like, all right, well, what do they need us for, right? And I don't fully understand it myself, but it is a crazy concept. Let's go to back to Gwen here in the comments. Thanks, David, for your question. Gwen asking, thanks for the answer to my first question. One more for you. With the pace of change of technology in our industry, do you think that large language models are going to be able to handle languages of lesser diffusion? Great question. Yes. Examples, Hmong, Navajo, etc. Accurately within the next few years. Or do you think some languages will be left out of this revolution? I feel like these types of languages are the final frontier for a lot of the industry's technology. Couldn't have said it better myself, Gwen.
Yes, I think that's a super interesting question. And I think the problem with those languages is, like, who's going to sponsor for technology to solve them? Because they're so long tail that LSPs don't make any money out of them. So there has to be money coming from some public institutions.
Academia or government.
And that's super useful. Having said that, I believe that the abstractions of LLMs are much stronger than the abstractions that neural MT systems have, just because of, like, A, the size, the way they are trained, and the type of question that they're having to answer. So with much less data from these languages, you can potentially get much better results on the end result. The other thing that I don't know if...
So let me just stop there, just to clarify, because you say something that's really smart, and I need to dumb it down for myself. So you're saying nowadays, with the new technology, it takes less data to feed into it to get good results than it did 5 years ago.
That's my belief.
Okay.
Just because, like, the way I see it is, like, the abstractions that you're creating on language are much stronger with these huge language models.
Okay.
And so if you think about it, whenever you add a language, you're basically just trying to align the representations from one language to the other. And it's, okay, this concept that matches in English now matches on this language. Then you need less data to do so. Okay. The other thing that I think it would be really interesting, I don't know if there's work on this area, so I'm just basically completely making this up, is because you have a lot of examples that you can use these models to generate data to train models. And there's this loop that the model is generating the data is training and actually improves on the data.
So not only are the machines evaluating the machines are training the machines.
But think about it, like, language is patterns. And these machines are way better than humans to recognize and generate patterns. So I think that's the underlying thing. Now, what I think it's interesting is these very long tail languages, they lack data just because they're long tail.
Yeah.
But I'm quite sure that somebody could actually write the grammar for them. Anyway, grammar is not going to encompass all the exceptions of a language. That's why rule-based systems never won. Maybe
the machine can write a grammar for them. Well, right. If it analyzes a data set and says,
I'm not sure if the machine will have enough data to generate the grammar. It's kind of like the chicken and the egg, but maybe you can write the grammar to generate some data to train the machine to improve on that language.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of interesting research that can be done. And here's the interesting part, by linguists. So you don't need to have an AI researcher doing this, which is normally concerned about models and not about the things of the language. You can have linguists playing with this, like, get the grammar, use them all to generate data, get that data to, like, iterate a little bit on the model learning, is it better on the language, and kind of, like, go in loops and try to make it better. So I think my point is, it's much better to make these models better to really long tail languages than it was with the previous technology. This technology is much more powerful.
I'm loving this conversation because you've said several things today that are not what I'm hearing out there in the ether, which is awesome because it's providing a different viewpoint on this. Typically, I hear long tail languages are going to get left out because there's just not enough data to exist, right? Like, in a couple weeks, I'm talking to the folks over at Bolingo Consult. They do a lot of work preserving and promoting African languages, for example. Mm-hmm. And last time I talked to them, and sign up for that podcast, by the way, listeners, it's going to be good. Last time I talked to them, the challenge was that there's just not enough data. There's not enough written content to feed into the machines. And so this is really heartening to hear that that's okay, because actually the requirements are getting smaller in order to get viable output.
Because I think the problem is not the data, so the problem is not the technology. The problem is the data. And if people are going to generate there, then this technology can help and make them better.
Interesting. Very cool. Let's go back. Raphael's asking exactly where I wanted to take this conversation. Says, how do you see the role of human expertise in the future of translation and localization with LLMs? Do you think it will be completely replaced? I ask this because data can be comprised not only for factuality, but also quality, e.g. bad translations, truncated data on the internet, etc. This is a big question. You know, lots of nuance in there, but go for it.
It is a huge question. And this is actually the question that investors have been asking me for the last 10 years in very different forms. Like, is ChatGPT going to kill Babel? Is Google Translate going to kill Babel? So several points. So first of all, as it stands, the best LLM for translation, the quality produced is still not at the levels that our customers need. So we still have humans that are going to review the loop. Is this going to change? Probably. When? I don't know. Having said that, there's always going, I think, translators are going more to the role of like linguists, like correcting the model, teaching the model, creating new applications for the model, like this, writing the prompts. So I don't think they'll go away. I think they'll have a lot of work. What I think you're going to do is, because it's going to be much more machine, and again, not just machine translation, I think there's a pipeline of machine modules to get a good translation, and machine translation is one of them. Basically, they're going to be able to be the ones coaching those systems, creating those systems. So I don't think they'll run out of work. I do think that there's like an idea, and again, this is another idea that I haven't explored, so take it as is, that is super interesting, which is, think about this. I'm a translator.
Yeah.
Right now I'm bounded by the amount of words that I can translate per hour. Now we know that these models are highly capable of translating, and they're highly coachable in the sense that you can look at the translate and say, oh, in this case, I wouldn't say this, I would say this differently, and he learns. You can think about, and you can do this as a kind of an agent or as like a customized chatbot on ChatGPT. Now think that you're a translator, but actually what you have is you have 10 chatbots from your, like 10 chat translators that you coach for specific domains where you do the research and you add the research to the model. Basically, you become a little bit like a Pokemon coach, where each Pokemon is like a specific translator that is translated. And so you maximize your throughput as a translator. You're still the one in charge. You're still the one in the research. You're still the one teaching the model how to translate. You're still the one in the LQA afterwards. You're basically like making yourself more productive by having these things working on your behalf.
Yeah.
And so you said that you're a freelancer. You have a host of freelancers that work for you. I don't know exactly how we do this, but it's something that I've been thinking for a while that I would like to explore.
Yeah, it's making yourself more scalable, essentially. Yeah. Right. And I think that's a great mindset for translators, linguists, I need to start calling them, right, out there. So rather than being afraid of the technology, think about how you can use it to make your own work more scalable, higher quality, all of that stuff. And as I mentioned, I got to go pick up my kiddos here pretty soon. Summer break. So I can't do the full hour, but I want to ask you, I want to close with this maybe. It's a question I like to ask folks like you. I've asked it before, I'm going to ask you, which is, I'm 18 years old, I just graduated from high school, and my dream is to become a translator, translator interpreter, and go study translation and interpretation out there at the university. What classes do I need to be taking? If I'm just getting started and I want to start as a translator or an interpreter, obviously I need to study language. Right? Or maybe so obviously. What else?
So I like to think that most people are intelligent. And so I do trust on the translation study courses. In the same way that they teach CAT nowadays, and they didn't 10 years ago, they adapted. They will start teaching LLM how to interact with these things and how to prompt them. There's no benefit from not teaching them.
My fear with that, though, is I'm a cynic. I'm a skeptic, right? My fear with that is academia moves pretty slow. And the rate of change in technology out there is moving pretty fast right now. So how can academia keep up?
That's a good question. I haven't thought about that. I think they are keeping up. I think academia should teach you the fundamentals. They should teach you how to think.
Okay.
How to be basically, how to think, how to...
The timeless skills, right?
Yeah, because those are the ones that don't change, because everyone, like, and then tell you, like, go to ChatGPT and try it out. Like, play, like, incentivize people to use it. And, you know, it's not hard to say, I'm going to change a little bit of my evaluation. I'm going to make an example that I'm going to make you use ChatGPT without anything else to see how it works. But mostly academia is not there to teach you the latest trend of tools, because otherwise you'll be outdated in 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense. All right. Well, Joe, any closing thoughts? How do people get a hold of you? Talk to me.
Unbabble.
Talk to me about that.
So my email is very simple. It's joao@unbabble.com. It's like the privilege of being the first one, given that Joao is the most famous name in Portugal. LinkedIn, email, chat, I'm always open to talk and to learn more. So very happy to talk with anyone.
Yeah, guys. Like I said before, make sure that you're following NIMSY Insights out there so you can find out when we publish new episodes like this. You can join us live. Go follow Joe. Go follow Unbabble. Check out unbabble.com. You can find out more about the products we've been talking about today and what they're investing in over there. And with that, I'm going to wrap it up here. Thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, ladies, gentlemen, chat, we are out of time for today. So if you enjoyed this NIMSY Live experience, join us next week, I want to say. Go check our LinkedIn, and we have a calendar of NIMSY Lives coming up. I appreciate our guest, Joe. I appreciate my colleagues here at NIMSY Insights doing all the hard work so I can have these fun conversations. And finally, I appreciate you, the audience, joining us live today. All of the questions and comments and chats, and I look forward to next time. Cheers.